This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
This article is from Fortune. For 35 years, Fortune has been tracking the world's largest companies in our Global 500 ranking. It's a strong barometer of global business, and last year, a couple of trends collided to shake it up. Energy prices cooled, knocking down revenues for companies such as Saudi Aramco and ExxonMobil, and AI got red hot, fueling a boom for tech giants like NVIDIA and Microsoft. Which companies being built today will grow to be the world's largest? It's the job of venture capitalists to figure that out. No VC firm has picked winners better than Sequoia Capital. In 1978, it gave Steve Jobs $150,000 to create Apple, now worth $3.6 trillion. Sequoia was also first to back NVIDIA in 1993. It cut early checks for Google, Cisco, YouTube, and Airbnb. Over the course of the firm's lifetime, Sequoia has returned more than $70 billion to its investors, with more than half of that, some $43 billion, paying out in just the past 5 years. In fact, more than 25% of the market cap of the NASDAQ comes from companies underwritten by Sequoia. Unsurprisingly, AI is an asset that Sequoia thinks a lot of future giants, will deploy. It views AI as a fundamental technology on par with the invention of electricity. More than 60% of the firm's investments last year went to AI-focused companies. But even Sequoia acknowledges that the gap between what we're spending on AI and the business it's generating is the $600 billion elephant in the room. For all the promise of the technology, where's the revenue? Other than OpenAI, another Sequoia-backed company, which is reportedly generating income at a $3.4 billion annual rate, few startups have proved they can capture cash as well as they can burn it. The result could be a nasty AI hangover that hits both private and public markets. In the case of many viewer technologies, speculative investment frenzies often lead to high rates of capital incineration. Sequoia most recently wrote in a blog post, "It's hard to pick winners, but much easier to pick losers." We recently sat down with the head of Sequoia Capital, Roelof Botha, at our Brainstorm Tech Conference in Park City, Utah, and at greater length for this issue's cover story. As he told Fortune's Michael Levram, "Winning isn't everything, it's the only thing." To learn how he's guiding the firm to sort winners from losers, we'll turn to another article later on. One Sequoia company that's still charting its path and betting on AI to catapult it further is Robinhood. The company began as a mobile first day trading app for millennials, and it helped spark a meme stock frenzy. But Vlad Tenev has ambitions to hold a serious financial firm that can rival behemoths like Fidelity and Charles Schwab. Jeff John Roberts sat down with Tenev to learn more about how he's transforming the company and how he has transformed himself as a leader. Becoming a financial giant may seem unlikely for the upstart app, but as one fintech investor tells Roberts, sometimes the pirates become the Navy. At the crown of Roelof Botha's otherwise perfectly coiffed light brown head of hair, there's a small patch that's gone completely white. It's the result of a serious concussion Botha incurred in his 20s while playing rugby, his sport of choice in his native South Africa, and in business school at Stanford. That injury ended his playing days, but spent some time with Botha, who's now the head of Sequoia Capital, one of the oldest, largest, and most successful firms in venture capital, and rugby will come up again and again. Botha cites lessons from rugby and talks with founders and colleagues, and watches it devotedly while he exercises. The game has provided him with endless analogies about the value of teamwork and resilience, and some decent one-liners. Soccer is 90 minutes of pretending to be hurt when you're not, Botha tells me, and rugby is 80 minutes of pretending not to be hurt with blood spewing on your face. While some soccer fans might quibble with the comparison, rugby is indisputably not for the faint of heart. Then again, neither is Botha's other passion, venture capital. The industry that has become a financing pipeline for young, innovative, and risky companies is known for dramatic booms and busts, and is coming off a particularly harrowing cycle. A COVID-era bump in demand for all things tech helped VC funds raise and invest record amounts. In 2021, as an unprecedented 340 new U.S. startups achieved unicorn status, or valuations of $1 billion or more, then in 2022 came a correction triggered by high interest rates and a slumping stock market, a decline that bloodied balance sheets and left many people wondering whether the VC model itself was broken. It's against this backdrop that Botha, who appears to be equal parts jock and nerd, a true unicorn, has taken the mantle. The former wunderkind and charter member of the PayPal Mafia became senior steward, Sequoia's term for its top job, in July 2022. After a reorganization, his title is now just steward. It's the culmination of a steady rise. Botha, who turns 51 in September, joined the firm in 2003 and had been running Sequoia's U.S. and Europe business since 2017. Scoring lucrative wins over the years with investments in YouTube, Instagram, and Square, among other blockbusters. All along, Botha has kept a low profile. My inclination was never to run to the spotlight, he says, but leading Sequoia comes with certain demands, not just to set strategy internally, but to explain it externally. So far, Botha's run has coincided not just with the VC turmoil, but with blunders specific to Sequoia. Still, the firm has ridden out the downturn better than most. It distributed more than $43 billion to its investors over the past 5 years, including $10 billion in 2023. Its limited partners, largely made up of endowments, charitable foundations, and not-profits, seem satisfied. Indeed, the base of investors in Sequoia's primary fund grew slightly from 2022 to 2023, from 354 to 358. It helps that the firm has delivered hit after hit, decade after decade. Sequoia has led investments in tech titans, including Apple, Cisco, and Google, plus newer names like NVIDIA, Airbnb, DoorDash, and WhatsApp, minting billions in returns along the way. More than 25% of the overall market capitalization of the NASDAQ, more than $7 trillion as of mid-July, is composed of Sequoia-backed companies. Sequoia's kingmaker position is also evident in less quantifiable ways. Securing dollars from the firm is one of tech's ultimate seals of approval. That stellar reputation is precisely what makes Botha's job so hard. The task isn't so much to fix what's broken as it is to keep what works from breaking, and not to be the guy who ends a 5-decade winning streak. And what's kept Sequoia at the top in the past won't necessarily keep it there, especially in a VC industry that's scrambling to adapt. "I want Sequoia to thrive," said Botha. "At an organization that has achieved so much, this is more daunting. It's much easier to be the underdog. That said, there's a reason Sequoia is the alpha. Its culture from the get-go has been one of near-paranoid competitiveness, ruthless honesty, and a constant need for change. Botha had become a paragon of these qualities. His probabilistic thinking, acumen, and factual recall make him a force at decision-making time. His intense curiosity helps him question old ways of deciding. Partners credit him with reshaping the way Sequoia thinks, just in time for a moment of industry-wide reset, not to mention an AI revolution. We're only as good as our next investment, Botha and his partners like to say, but any fear of failure on Botha's part is tempered with a relentless drive to master whatever he pursues, something he internalized as a boy in South Africa and, yes, on the rugby field. Using this ultimate sports aphorism, the steward of Sequoia told me any chance he got over the course of several interviews, winning isn't everything, it's the only thing. In mid-May, Sequoia gathered its partners and founders for a 2-day retreat on a cattle ranch in California's San Benito County. The dusty but picturesque venue was nestled so deep in rolling hills that there's little cellular reception. There wasn't even an address. Invitees were sent a set of longitude and latitude coordinates and told to download directions before they lost signal. Dubbed Base Camp, Sequoia's Far From Silicon Valley get-together is a fixture for its portfolio companies. Founders from all over the world attended this year's event, which featured master classes on effective founder storytelling and clear thinking, plus a Pala dinner under the stars. There were talks from Jensen Huang of NVIDIA, Fiji Simo of Instacart, and the former captain of South Africa's rugby team, of course, who bore an uncanny resemblance to Botha. But Base Camp is also about camping. Just a short walk from the barn where the talks took place was a grassy field dotted with neat rows of cream-colored yurts, the sleeping quarters for attendees. "The first year it was so cold, I thought we were going to die," says Julia Hartz, co-founder and CEO of ticketing platform Eventbrite, one of Botha's investments. "It's so Sequoia to take founders out and try to kill them just to prove a point." While this year's weather was milder, the tone set by Sequoia was similarly ascetic. The message repeated in toasts and talks and even spelled out in a book given to founders was clear. Being an entrepreneur, especially one backed by Sequoia, means embarking on a journey that requires intellectual honesty and grueling work. Shared outdoor bathrooms, sleeping in yurts, these elements were to be embraced, not just endured, in the spirit of building grit and resilience. Sequoia has long been known for its demanding, direct ethos. The approach isn't just for founders. Its internal culture is one of radical candor and open disagreement. Partners have veto power over deals. For each funding decision, the process includes a blind pre-vote meant to discourage groupthink. Botha sometimes pushes partners to re-argue a case if he feels they're being too positive. The steward has also welcomed pressure testing from Sequoia's own investors. He's always looking for critical feedback, which is not something you hear from many firms, said Eric Dopstad, Chief Investment Officer of the Ford Foundation. The Ford Foundation was the first LP to invest in Sequoia. Since taking over, Botha has had ample opportunity to receive such feedback, both solicited and unsolicited. There was the firm's 2023 decision to decouple from its China business, partly because of deteriorating relations between the U.S. and China, a move some thought was overdue. A boredom spat last year at Swedish fintech Klarna, involving former and current Sequoia partners, created embarrassing optics. But perhaps the biggest blight was the collapse of cryptocurrency exchange FTX in November 2022. Sequoia invested $150 million in FTX, all of which it lost, and critics savaged the firm for failing to better vet the company. FTX founder Sam Bankman-Fried was later convicted of a massive fraud. Botha ran to the fire. He quickly organized a call with investors, both to apologize for the massive loss of capital and to offer concrete ways Sequoia would improve its due diligence. LPs were mollified, and some were impressed. It was yet another twist in a rocky year, and another reminder that the firm can never stop adapting. It's not a profession where you master it and you're done, he says. The business keeps changing, and the technology you need to invest in keep changing, and you need to constantly reinvent yourself. One of the ways Botha has tried to reinvent Sequoia is by departing from the traditional 10-year cycle of VC funds. Such funds usually reap their returns through startup exits, IPOs, or acquisitions, but they often miss out on the enormous value created if a company soars after its IPO. What's more, funds, 10 years, sometimes timeliness, can induce angst when exits slow down owing to a short-term market downturns. That's why in February 2022, Botha launched the Sequoia Capital Fund, an open-ended liquid portfolio. His holdings include post-IPO equity in portfolio companies, along with allocations in more traditional funds. The firm is going all in, reorganizing itself around this new structure. Botha's timing was unlucky, as tech stocks tanked last year. But in some ways, that was the point. The strategy is meant to help Sequoia capitalize on investments over the long term, whether the market is up or down. Botha talks about market volatility, indeed about most things, without sounding especially up or down. At times, listening to him is like reading the world's most eclectic encyclopedia. Botha is measured, analytical, methodical. He can barely have a conversation without bringing up probability distribution curves. He can break down the impact of cold water currents on Bay Area microclimates just as easily as he explains the workings of a rugby scrum. Even when telling jokes, he keeps a book at them at his bedside. He delivers humor with a didactic twist, but everything he says is tinged with the soft accent of Afrikaans, his mother tongue. That's a reminder of the unusual path that eventually led him to Sequoia, and of the hidden layers of his personality. Did you know he makes jerky from exotic meats? Hearts of Eventbrite tells me. Seriously, you should ask him what he eats for breakfast. The next time I meet Sibota, I do just that, and he proceeds to rattle off the day's protein-heavy menu. This morning, it was some raw salmon and chicken meatballs, he says. Yesterday, I had bison, venison, impala, and good and whole chickens. We're talking feet and head still on, are also staples in both his refrigerator. A private chef handles the decapitating and cooking. The avid foodie likes to say that a meal without meat is a snack, a common attitude in his home country. Bota was born to a pair of star-crossed teenagers in Pretoria in 1973. His parents split when he was three. He grew up with his mother, but remained close to his dad's side of the family. He is named for his paternal grandfather, an Afrikaans tradition. In any baptism, there is a photo of four generations of Roloff Botas, he says. His dad, his grandfather, his great-grandfather, and himself. Later, his dad would have another son and name him Roloff Bota. It's Bota's grandfather who loomed largest in his life. Nicknamed Picked, the elder Bota served as South Africa's foreign minister in the last years of the apartheid regime, later joining Nelson Mandela's government after democratic elections ended apartheid. As a child, Bota had rare exposure to global dignitaries and business leaders who came to meet his grandfather. One of his earliest memories is of walking in his grandfather's garden with Pick as journalist for photograph the two of them. I had a sense of the impact that somebody can have in the world, he says, of those days. But that understanding went hand in hand with immense pressure. It's a little bit of a burden you carry, says Bota, that I'm named after this person and I have to live up to his person. There was another downside. Some assumed that any recognition he received was a product of nepotism. No matter how well he did in something, it must have been because of, well, you can finish that sentence, says Doug Leon, Sequoia's former senior steward, whom Bota succeeded in 2022. And that just drove him crazy. It also drove him to distinguish himself. In elementary school, Bota scored so high on an aptitude exam that the district brought in a psychologist for an assessment and to make sure he wasn't cheating. He studied up on how to study, reading books about best tests and note-taking tactics. His handwriting is freakishly neat. In college, he picked one of the most grueling majors, actuarial science, and earned the best undergraduate grade point average in the history of the University of Cape Town. Bota applied the same drive to his extracurriculars, playing for the top rugby team at his high school, competing in math and science Olympiads. It was around this time that the family doctor approached his mom and stepdad to express concern that Bota would burn out. The doctor was concerned Bota would burn out because of his obsessive studying and the intensity with which he approached pretty much everything. His response to it was to double down. I was like, I'll show you, said Bota. So straight-laced and focused was he that it was his mom who suggested he get an earring. He refused. To this day, Bota doesn't curse, saying that profanity is a sloppy way of expressing yourself. Despite his stellar record in South Africa, Bota felt that the only way to truly make a name for himself was to go somewhere where his name didn't mean anything to anyone. After college, Botta worked for consultant McKinsey's local office, where one of his managers, Stanford alum, suggested that Botta apply for its business school. Botta made the cut, packed his bags, and landed in Palo Alto at the age of 24. Soon enough, he fell in love with Silicon Valley, and the seemingly endless opportunities, and with his future wife, Huithan Chan, a fellow Stanford student. True to his track record, Botta graduated at the top of his class, this time without anyone assuming he had received preferential treatment, and yet it was a South African connection that propelled him into the center of the action. In the fall of 1999, a Stanford classmate introduced Botta to Elon Musk, a fellow South African who was running an online bank called XCOM. Musk saw something in Botta and worked hard to persuade him to come to XCOM, which was about to merge with another firm to create what would become PayPal. Botta, who had assumed he'd end up working with something cerebral like exotic derivatives, finally joined his startup in the spring of 2000. "I took the plunge, says Botta, and then 2 weeks later, the NASDAQ crashed. But even in those dark moments, there was a thrill of being a part of something potentially big and belonging to a team of intense, opinionated high performance. This was a group that Fortune later christened the PayPal Mafia, a cadre of future A-list investors and founders that also included Peter Thiel, Max Levchin, and Reid Hoffman. For all its talent, PayPal faced significant obstacles, including, increasingly, Musk himself. Musk was advocating unpopular moves, like killing off the PayPal brand even though consumers liked it. Botta became part of a core group that campaigned to remove Musk as CEO. "There were a lot of people at the company who thought it was his golden boy," said Botta, "but he was not running the company well." While Musk was on his honeymoon, Botta and other mutineers met with PayPal's lead investors to make their case. Those investors, Sequoia Capital. Musk was soon ousted, and Botta caught the eye of Sequoia partner Michael Moritz, who sat on PayPal's board. Botta later became CFO, and working with Sequoia on PayPal's IPO deepened the relationship. Sequoia was already a Silicon Valley legend. Don Valentin, a former semiconductor exec, famed for his eye for talent and his appetite for risk, started the firm in 1972. His first investment was in a fledgling video company called Atari, which he eventually sold to Warner Communications for a then unheard of $28 million, a 3x return. An even better return on that investment was an introduction to a young technician at Atari, Steve Jobs. In 1978, Valentine put $150,000 into Apple, and the rest was tech history. In 2003, after a months-long interview process, Botta was on the verge of getting an offer, but some Sequoia leaders worried that Botta was missing a critical strand in his DNA, a humanity gene, as Leon calls it. Leon recalls partners wondering, is he normal? Can he work with him? Can he be part of a team? Leon says Valentine himself wondered how Botta would handle failure, given that he'd so much success. Valentine died in 2019. Leon was tasked to suss out what Botta was really like. "When I started going there, we talked a lot about rugby. I don't know rugby, but Roloff swears There is no team sport like rugby. And talking about extreme competition and teamwork, it turned out, uncovered Botha's emotive side. Indeed, those who know Botha best describe him as unexpectedly sentimental. During our conversations, Botha teared up several times. Once, for example, when talking about his late stepfather, who played a pivotal role in his life. Proving his ability to remote was critical to Birch's hiring. Keeping feelings in check eventually proved just as important. Botha hit a home run early on, investing in 2005 in a little-known video sharing site called YouTube, which Google acquired for $1.65 billion just a year later. But then he entered what VC call the Valley of Despair, when bets aren't paying off, or worse, are leading to loss after loss. Botha credits Leon and Jim Getz, another senior partner, for supporting him without coddling him. The experience gave Botha empathy for the failures that almost all founders go through. He often talks about crucible moments that shape the trajectory of a company or entrepreneurs. This was one of his own. He eventually snapped his losing streak, investing in companies including Instagram, Tumblr, and genetic testing company Natera, all of which earned substantial exits. For years, Botha wrote 10 to the power of 9 at the right-hand corner of each sheet of paper in his copiously filled, impeccably legible notebooks. It was a reminder of a goal he had set for himself, to produce $1 billion in gains for Sequoia. He hit that milestone in 2015. He also repaired the relationship that had launched his Silicon Valley career. About a decade ago, Botha and Musk sat down for lunch. For the first time, they spoke about their upbringing in South Africa. "We both felt empathy for each other," says Botha. "That rekindled our ability to have a conversation. It also opened the door to investments in Musk's new companies." In May 2022, Sequoia announced that it had contributed to Musk's $44 billion takeover of Twitter, creating the roller coaster riding company now known as X. Sequoia was not an early backer of SpaceX, to Botha's regret, but it placed a late-stage bet on the company in 2019, and this year it invested in yet another Musk company, participating in a $6 billion round of funding in XAI, part of a focus on artificial intelligence that has become a hallmark of Botha's stewardship. Sequoia is no AI newbie. The firm put money in OpenAI in 2021 before ChatGPT was cool. But under Botha, it has increased the intensity of its AI focus. Last year, 60% of Sequoia's new investments were AI-focused. In 2024 so far, it's made at least 10 such investments. When I talk with Botha in mid-June, he's pondering a new puzzle: AI's sky-high computing cost. "It's unsustainable at this level," he says, but he's jazzed about a new Sequoia startup called Fireworks. He explains that its goal is to make inference, the process of deploying AI to draw conclusions from new data, way less expensive. The company that reaches that goal, he implies, could have Google-like upside. Whatever tech Sequoia is assessing, Botha wants it to do so with a fresh mindset. Jim Getz, who was Sequoia's steward for the U.S. and Europe until he passed the baton to Botha in 2017, says Botha has reshaped the firm's decision-making strategy in fundamental ways. Botha has rolled out pre-parades, thought experiments, in which partners imagine not just what can go wrong with the best, yet a best-case scenario of each potential investment, he's also brought in learnings from behavioral psychology, including a prospect theory which asserts that people feel losses more deeply than gains, sometimes leading to faulty decisions. We've modified our entire investment process to benefit from such approaches. Botha has also emphasized becoming more friendly and transparent with entrepreneurs. Sequoia's longtime kingmaker status led it to come across as elitist to some, but Botha has helped combat that perception, multiple founders told me. Jack Dorsey told me, Jack Dorsey first pitched Sequoia on his company Player Square in 2010. They were preachy and condescending, Dorsey says of the firm. Still, he wanted and eventually got Botha on his board. As the former CFO of PayPal, Roloff had a bunch of experience we wanted. The most helpful thing that any board member can do is provide context, and he's done a lot of that. Botha, Dorsey adds, remains the only investor that's reached out to ask what his firm can do better. Dorsey told Botha that Sequoia should encourage more engineers to contribute to open source code. Botha took it to heart, starting an open source fellowship program. Today, Botha remains a director at Block, the company Square eventually became a part of. He also sits on the boards of eight other companies, includes MongoDB and Unity Technologies. Kevin Systrom, the co-founder of Instagram, says his relationship with Sequoia, which joined his Series B round in 2012, was also built on rapport with Botha. He's not your typical VC sales guy archetype, where he's smooching you and taking you to play golf. And I really found myself drawn to that, says Systrom. Today, Botha says his biggest priority is keeping Sequoia involved throughout the life cycle of great companies, getting in on very early stage deals, and staying invested as they grow past the startup stage. It's a huge competitive advantage, he asserts, to be able to partner with companies from concept to long after an IPO. One initiative with that aim launched in 2022 is ARC, an immersion program for early stage startups. Entrepreneurs accepted into the 5-week program are taught the Sequoia way to start, build, and scale ever enduring companies. They're also given funding and the right to say they raise money from Sequoia. There's a lot of folks who would probably say, just don't do that, just go invest. But Botha, she says, is willing to both fund and invest and believe in those new ideas. Innovating is critical, says Botha, given the iffy landscape for startup exits. Historically, slightly more than half of Sequoia's exits have been through M&A. As regulators have moved to curb big tech, however, it has become difficult for companies to get acquired. This concerns Botha, who sees the overall health of the VC sector as vital to the broader economy. I don't think you can find a single technology company that is a public company in the last 20 or 30 years that wasn't VC-backed along the way, he says. As far as his own success, he's changed the metrics. It's no longer his own goals or the 10 to the power of 9 number in the corner of his notebook. It's collective success that counts. For me, it's not personal winning now. It's the winning of us as a team. And a tight-knit team is invaluable. because in venture capital, just like in rugby, another fiercely competitive scrum is always just around the corner. Golf gets a tech upgrade. For more than a century, golfers have been teeing off on public courses and private country clubs. But in recent years, an increasing number of players have opted for alternatives beyond the green. From driving ranges to indoor simulators, off-course golf has more than doubled in the last decade, totaling 32.9 million participants in 2023. This is according to the National Golf Association. While on golf's course now, accounts for less than one half of the game in the U.S., but it's not just recreational golfers who are jumping on this growing alternative golf trend. PGA Tour superstars Tiger Woods and Rory McIlroy are launching TGL presented by SoFi, a new high-tech golf league under their company TMRW Sports, which is making the game off the grass and into a custom-built arena in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. When the season officially begins in January 2025, six teams comprised of PGA Tour standouts will go head-to-head in a season-long competition, offering fans a way to experience the game like never before. We have a sport with 600 years of history and tradition, combined with technology that allows for a lot of opportunities to help golf continue to accelerate its cultural relevance with different groups of fans, said Mike McCarley, CEO and a founder of TMRW Sports, who advised the TGL concept alongside Woods and McIlroy. We wanted to combine star power and a progressive approach to team golf that would resonate with fans. TGL, which was developed in partnership with the PGA Tour, will introduce a range of cutting-edge technology to the game. And it certainly won't be the usual simulator golf available in a retail shop or sports bar. The SoFi Center combines a huge screen with a state-of-the-art game complex that transforms the landscape between each hole. TGL is teaming up with some of the world's most iconic golfers, integrating new technology and competitive elements into the game and taking it to prime time all at once, said Anthony Noto, CEO of a presenting sponsor, SoFi. Our industries have a lot in common. Golf and banking have been around for centuries. They reach millions of people, and they're ripe for innovation. TGL teams will compete in a season of head-to-head matches on a field that is 97 yards long and 50 yards wide. Throughout each match, every shot will be broadcast live on ESPN and ESPN Plus, and each player will be mic'd for a more immersive experience, including strategy discussions among teammates. Golf will start from real grass tee boxes, swinging toward custom-designed virtual holes that will be projected onto a 3,000-square-foot screen, roughly 20 times the size of a standard simulator. But once the balls are inside approximately 50 yards, they will transition to live action and finish each hole within TGL's green zone, a 22,475-foot short game complex with promises to test the world's best players' creativity. a 41-yard wide turntable will rotate the green to create offering different approach angles, and nearly 600 machine actuators will morph its topography. Overall, the season will include 15 matches plus playoffs. Our aim is for TGL to be approachable and easily understood by golf fans, as well as fans of traditional team sports who may not regularly follow the PGA Tour in and out. It's not a secret that we're all crunched for time, so our focus has always been to create a two-hour primetime match in which one team leaves the winner. Across TGL, the inaugural franchises represent the cities of Atlanta, Boston, Los Angeles, New York, San Francisco, and Palm Beach. Each group has already attracted a noteworthy owner. One major name is Fenway Sports Group, which founded the Boston Common Golf Team, joining the ranks of Alexis Ohanian and Serena and Venus Williams, who own the Los Angeles Golf Club. We've been successful over the past two decades in how we've been able to make the Fenway Park experience out to the community, and we know we can replicate and build on that success with this new venture, said Sam Kennedy, CEO of FCG, a global sports, marketing, media, entertainment, and real estate company. Technology is a huge advantage and part of the hallmark of TGL that will allow us to create experiences locally. In June, Boston golf fans were delighted with the news that Masters and nine-time PGA Tour winner Hideki Matsuyama would be joining the Boston Commons golf team alongside McIlroy, Keegan Bradley, and Adam Scott. Additionally, solo artist and singer-songwriter Niall Horan and his investment group, Greenbid Ventures, took an ownership stake in the franchise. We are excited about the opportunity to help grow golf in the New England community and provide access to the game, especially with the next generation of golfers and fans, says Kennedy. This new league will showcase golf in a way it's never been seen before, and we think it's going to resonate with existing fans and those who are new to the sport. What can business expect from the next president? There's one thing Republicans and Democrats can agree on: higher tariffs on imports to America. Here are the challenges both parties' proposals would pose for corporate leaders. Every day you're paying a tax that Congress never voted on, a tax that's rapidly getting heavier. Yet you may not even know when you're paying this tax because it goes by another name, tariffs. It is baked into the prices of products, from sneakers to semiconductors to compression springs that are manufactured abroad or that use imported components or materials. That is a large portion of the things Americans buy. As the presidential election approaches, all signs point to higher tariffs on American imports, no matter who wins. While Vice President Kamala Harris was a clear favorite to be the Democratic nominee as of this article went to press, it's safe to say that any potential rival would have a similar trade agenda. The consequences will reach far beyond those ballooning hidden taxes that Americans pay. They will also influence global geopolitics and touch every business and consumer in the U.S., plus billions more worldwide. The trend is still hard to believe for those who have been following the issue. After the decades of working for freer trade worldwide, the U.S. has reversed course with both parties on board. The two sides don't offer identical trade proposals. Donald Trump would be much more severe, but broadly speaking, this is a rare issue in which on both sides of the aisle are aligned. Both parties are pursuing this agenda to assert their commitment to protect American industry and jobs from overseas competition. But business mostly doesn't like it, especially companies selling goods to price-sensitive customers already wary of inflation. Unfortunately, there does seem to be this movement within both parties to turn insular and turn away from trade in ways that will be economically damaging, says Neil Bradley, Chief Policy Officer at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. They're going to end up hurting average Americans. Tariff proponents, in making their case, often cloud how they work. Tariffs require U.S. importers of foreign goods and services to pay duties to the U.S. Treasury based on what was imported. Research over decades finds that importers pass the extra costs onto consumers in the form of higher prices, or they are forced to cut costs or accept lower profits. This simple fact tends to be missing from the populist rhetoric. The exporting company does not pay the tariff. The importing company does. Donald Trump's campaign boasts that as president, Trump imposed tariffs on China that brought billions of dollars into the federal treasury, failing to note that it was American consumers and companies who paid those billions. Joe Biden's White House said often that tariffs be imposed to protect American workers and businesses, without mentioning that those tariffs have also hurt many workers and businesses. David French, the National Retail Foundation's top government relations executive, tells Fortune, "Our hope is the next administration will move into a more comprehensive, non-tariff trade barrier discussion that includes multilateral negotiations. We'd love to be writing trade deals again." He's likely to be disappointed. As the campaigning heats up, Democrats will likely stand on Biden's record of imposing tariffs, pointing proudly to steeply increased tariffs on Chinese steel, aluminum, semiconductors, electric vehicles, batteries, solar cells, and more. Trump goes much further, proposing a 60% tariff on all Chinese imports and a universal 10% tariff on imports from all countries, radically high and broad tariffs not seen in the U.S. since World War II. Goldman Sachs calculates Trump's program would raise inflation by 1.1 percentage points and reduce the gross domestic product, GDP, growth by a half a point, a significant drop when GDP has most recently been growing at an annual rate of only 1.4%. Trump's tariffs would cost a middle-income household $1,700 a year, according to the Peterson Institute for International Economics. News that the U.S. is enthusiastically cranking up tariffs under both parties would have sounded otherworldly for most of the past 75 years. For the first portion of U.S. history, the bulk of the federal government's revenue in some years, nearly 100%, came from tariffs. The country began to trim its reliance on tariffs after a 1930 constitutional amendment allowed income tax. Then, at the end of World War II, 28 countries banded together to negotiate agreements that would reduce tariffs and other trade barriers, reasoning that lowering these barriers to free trade would leave all the participating countries better off. That group's success to the World Trade Organization today has 164 member countries whose progress over the decades has been dramatic. In 1948, the U.S. collected tariffs that were 14% of the value of all tariff imports and 6% of total imports. By 2017, the respective tariff rates had plunged to 5% and 1%. Then everything changed. In 2018, President Trump, who had famously tweeted that trade wars are good and easy to win, followed through by launching a grand-scale trade war. He imposed a slew of tariffs that eventually covered Argentina, Brazil, Canada, China, and European Union, India, Mexico, and South Korea. Most of those countries quickly lost retaliatory tariffs against the U.S., which in turn hurt American manufacturers' abilities to compete in these growing overseas markets. Result of the trade war? A draw at best. U.S. imports fell, but so did exports because of the retaliation. In February, the authors found that U.S. consumers and firms that bought imports lost $52 billion, and the researchers discovered the tariffs appeared to be intensely political. Here's a quickie. This is a list of the Fortune Global 500 largest companies by revenue. Of course, Walmart is number one at $648 billion. Amazon is second. State Grid from China is third. Saudi Aramco from Saudi Arabia is fourth. And fifth is Sinopec Group from China. And then number six is the China National Petroleum. Number seven is Apple, and number eight